Today on Movie Rollers, we talk about In Search of Israeli Cuisine. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online, and streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings.
Hello.
I knew you'd catch me in the middle of chomping on a piece of cracker.
It's not just that I timed it to catch you in the middle of
and
chomping on a piece.
And I took a big bite.
Covered with our good friend Baba Ganoush from our last podcast.
Correct.
Yes. Our wise friend Baba Ganoush.
Is now being devoured by Rashmi here.
Correct.
Can we talk about...
Yeah, we can talk about anything you like, Yazdi. This is our podcast.
Yes. Can we talk about this trailer for the remake of It, which seemingly has broken the record for the most number of downloads ever for a trailer for any movie?
And people who are not normally excited about movie on my Facebook stream are excited about It or have had something to say about the movie trailer. But I haven't watched the trailer.
Yeah,
it's a Stephen King.
It's a Stephen King novel.
Yeah, no, I know the book.
Remake of the film.
Right. I was just surprised. I haven't seen the trailer either.
I'm too scared.
Yeah, everybody's like, it's
is
really
it the one with the killer clown?
Yes.
Isn't that the phenomenon that happened last year? I don't know if it was real or not, but there was this internet thing about there being like these killer clowns, and I think it started in New Jersey of all places.
How horrible.
Yeah, it's
but
true.
I'm not sure if it was like one of these fake news things.
Oh, or maybe in preparation for the movie.
I hate the word fake news now because come the November election, fake news has been.
Right.
But actually, there was a fake news phenomenon where, you know, these stories would get written up and then passed around via Facebook. And Killer Clowns, I think, is one of them. So you carry on talking about the trailer. I'm going to quickly look up the Killer Clowns on Snopes.com.
You know, when you think about like Star Wars or when you think about some really big mega event, and that trailer gets released, and yet somehow this It trailer gets more hits in a 24-hour period than something for Star Wars or something for, I don't know, you know, Star Trek or something, you know, some major franchise. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, that is fascinating and how it doesn't this happens.
I don't know what.
Obviously, the marketing guys are delighted.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know this remake was coming.
Yeah. It literally happened on, like, Wednesday of this week.
Yeah.
So, have you ever been to Snopes.com?
Yes.
It's a fact-checking website.
Yes, yes.
And they exist to debunk, basically, myths. And they also provide pretty interesting analyses of things that are also real, right? Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe unexplained. But they do a really nice job of debunking stories. So, yes, they have... They're saying here that there was a whole bunch of news stories last year about creepy clown murders. Here we have, if you Google it, you find that this isn't really true stuff that happened. So, but nonetheless, it was an internet phenomenon, and I have a couple of people at work. They shall remain nameless in case they happen to listen, which they probably won't, but they hear me enough at work. But the story, the creepy clown thing was propagated by one of them, and I think it tends to be bought by those people who are a little bit younger, maybe a little less questioning of things that they get in their Facebook feed, their social media feeds, and but creepy clowns was a big thing last year for a lot of people, and it was it turned out to be this fluffy fake new stuff, but it is
coming.
It is coming, yes.
It is coming.
Yes.
Then maybe I should watch the trailer.
Yes, watch the trailer and let us know.
Maybe we'll watch it after the podcast.
Yes, together.
There are some trailers that are genuinely frightening. What was the one that
Conjuring had a really scary trailer.
Yeah, there was...
The original was Conjuring. Scary,
The one with the clapping.
Oh, my word.
Oh, my God. That was really scary.
I know, there was one that...
Yes, you won't let me forget that now.
Oh, I will not. My life was ruined.
That's right.
You did. Sleep was escaped.
Sleep was escaped, yes.
Isn't it amazing how a horror film can do that to you?
It's horrible.
All right, so let's jump over into our Netflix picks, because we only have one movie to review this week, so we do have time for our segment, I Can't Find Anything to Watch on Netflix, and we talk about movies that are upcoming on Netflix, and if you are struggling with either too much choice, because that can happen with Netflix, as well as maybe not knowing some of the movie names, this is our job, our role here to direct you, so... what's in your Netflix queues, guys?
So I'm doing a Joe this week. I'm going for The Prestige, which was Christopher Nolan's 2006 movie about magicians. And I came late to the party for this one. But my, what an interesting movie. And not just interesting, but interesting, entertaining, and a great cast with Christian Bale, Hugh Jackman, Rebecca Hall, Michael Caine, Scarlett Johansson, and Piper Perabo. Really good movie, periody, you know, ye olde times when magicians were almost like superstars in little towns, and really a rivalry that occurs between two magicians.
Yeah.
Brilliant movie.
And it's pretty intense, and
it's got
great production
in
design.
It.
And
it's really good.
I really want Christopher Nolan to make a small film again. He needs to make The Prestige again. He's getting bigger and bigger in his scope.
Yeah. Whoa.
But he needs to come back to the smaller stuff. He's so good with that.
Of course, because Dunkirk is going to be epic.
Of course.
I'm sure.
I mean, it's interesting because we somehow missed The Prestige when it came out. And, you know, with my subsequent interest in the Nolanverse.
Yeah.
You know, this is one that we went back and watched. We also watched Memento, I think, in a similar time frame, just because we were really trying to learn... about Nolan's earlier work. It's superb. It's a very
different Christian Bale and a different Hugh Jackman. I really like Hugh Jackman in this movie,
and it's very clever.
Yes, I think
that's the thing that the movie genuinely surprised me with how it unfolded. Good stuff, good pick. Yazdi.
So my recommendation is a movie that I saw at the very first Tribeca Film Festival that I attended, and when I walked out of that movie, I was convinced this movie was going to be a huge hit because it's just written and directed so beautifully. And this movie had a particular resonance for me after the actor Anton Yelchin died so prematurely last year.
So unfortunately and freakishly, it's a heartbreak.
He's such a lovely actor, always, never more than completely natural.
Yeah.
And here he's in a wonderfully written New York set, you know, hopelessly romantic drama called 5 to 7. And it's now on Netflix, and it's essentially based, it tells the story of a rather young guy who happens to run into, he's an aspiring novelist, and he happens to run into this woman who is married to a very high level diplomat in New York City. And she's maybe a little bit older than him. Mm-hmm. And, they just start talking, and it's kind of like Before Sunrise a little bit in terms of how they realize how, you know, they come from totally different backgrounds, but they have so much in common. And over time, this relationship develops between them, and it sort of starts to threaten her marriage. It starts to threaten his peace of mind. And then they decide to tell her husband about it, and his reaction to it is completely contrary to what you would expect. But it just feels Woody Allen-esque in terms of the dialogue. It's very wry.
Sounds interesting.
And it's also about a young person, you know, learning about love and learning about, you know, all the pain that it entails. And I don't know, it's just a most wistful, lovely movie. It has Anton Yelchin, Berenice Marlowe, who was a Bond girl. It has Glenn Close in a small role. It has Lambert Wilson, remember him? So really nice little fun movie. I just watch it for the dialogue. It's lovely. It's really lovely. 5 to 7. Well, it's called 5 to 7 because that's the only time of the day when the two of them can meet, because her husband doesn't come back home until 7. So they have this... tradition of meeting between 5 and 7 every evening and talking. They meet in Central Park and just talk. And then the relationship grows. Anyway, 5 to 7. Check it out, guys.
Sounds
wistful
like a,
sounds.
Sounds
yeah.
like a Yazdi movie.
Yeah. Sounds like a
completely
yeah.
Yazdi.
Did you cry?
Is it I did. It just devastated me. Frank Langella is in it as well. And it has a very realistic kind of ending as well. as unrealistic as the plot might be.
Beautiful. Oh, that sounds interesting.
Intrigued.
Yes.
And then my pick is a movie that came out last year and was Oscar nominated, although it didn't actually win in the animation category, but Kubo and the Two Strings.
Kubo! Kubo! Go Kubo!
Now, I recommend this despite the fact that I'm a bit less enthusiastic than the pair of you.
Kubo! Sorry.
We didn't review this on Movie Wallers. And so, you know, this movie is running a stunning 97% approval on Rotten Tomatoes, and yeah, my reaction to it is probably a little different than many, in that I admired the movie. It's so achingly, jaw-droppingly beautiful in every frame. They use a mixture of stop motion animation, CG. It has a soundtrack, and that's just marvelous and memorable. You know, the characters are beautifully drawn and the story is genuinely moving. I think the movie frustrated me a little in that I didn't really understand the story, and maybe it's because I'm looking looking for more than just some of the metaphorical themes that it had going in it. But it's a stunning movie, and I can't wait, actually, depending on when you listen to this podcast. I think it comes out later in April, in the second half of April on Netflix. But I can't wait for it to be on Netflix, because the opportunity of viewing it a second time has been up there. I mean, I wanted to see it again in the movie theater, despite not loving it, just because it was beautiful, and it kind of overwhelmed me with its visuals. So I think I was distracted in some way by how it looked, and less involved emotionally. But you guys loved it, right?
Oh, this is beautiful. And again, it's one of those movies, you know, I think it explores loss and grief in a very relatable, well, clearly not for you, Joe.
Movie was interesting.
It really does cover loss and grief and a child losing their parents in a very realistic, relatable way and an unusual way. And I think that it explores how family can be many different things.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily those who are born of the same parents as you, in a way.
And I think, as emotionally resonant as it is, I think it's also visually quite unlike what you've seen. I mean, I can't quite describe it. It has a very strange texture. It doesn't seem like a typical animated movie. There's a lot of emphasis almost on, you know, folded paper in the movie. There's a lot of things which fold.
Origami.
Yeah. It's very inspired by origami.
And it's just beautiful.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. It almost seems like
you can touch. It feels like you can touch it. Yeah.
But it feels artificial, but at the same time, it feels unlike anything else you've seen. So I think just from a, you know, visual perspective, you need to check it out.
Yeah.
I know there's great something choice there for me, because Chris Butler, who wrote this movie, also wrote Paranorman, which is, you know, that's a movie that is interesting. It came and went. I watched it and then I can't get it out of my mind. It's such a powerful movie.
Yeah.
So I know that there's something here for me. So Kubo and the Two Strings, 527.
The Prestige. Great choices again.
Great picks on Netflix. Don't complain that your Netflix subscription isn't getting you value for money. I don't think anyone does these days, because there's just a ton of content there.
You know, I think if we ever have time, we should do a movie wall as things we've been binge watching, TV stuff.
Yeah,
we never.
Because there's so much.
It's true. Yeah,
so much good material.
Yeah.
The Netflix original content.
I have agreed for cable to be cancelled. That's how good Netflix is.
Okay, here it is on the record, movie wall as. 10 minutes into this podcast, Rashmi has agreed. Let's see how that goes.
As a trial run. Maybe it's a trial.
It's a trial pilot.
If Rashmi's a little cranky on the next podcast, it might be because I cancelled. I actually followed through on cancelling cable. All right. So we have one movie to talk about this week, or this episode, because this is the timing of this release needs to be in line with its San Diego release. So that's why we're recording it on its own. This is why we have a standalone podcast. So just so that if this is a little out of sequence with any other podcast we release, that's why. So let's talk about the movie In Search of Israeli Cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, the title of the movie, I haven't seen the movie, but the title of the movie couldn't be more simple in terms of the content of the movie. And I'll start off by saying that about a couple of years ago, I happened to be in Philadelphia for a conference from work, and one of my colleagues who works in the Philadelphia College Will area, even before we were all going to show up there, he said, oh my God, if you guys are coming to Philadelphia, I'm going to make sure I take you to the best restaurant there is in Philadelphia. And it's this restaurant called Zahav. And, you know, he went ahead and made reservations for us. And, you know, we are all foodies and we love food. And honestly, that was one of the best meals I've had in my life. And not just because the food was exceptional, but it's just the whole layout of the restaurant. It's in the most unlikely place. In fact, you step out of it late at night and there's like nothing there. You know, it's not in a busy street. And yet it's very open and it has a very social feel to it and it's buzzing and it's loud and it's very kind of, you know, gosh, people mingling and mixing and it just feels like a free world. It's really very nice. And I had a great, you know, I had a great, great experience there. And then I find out that the chef of that restaurant, Michael Solomonov, he went and did this documentary, which is called In Search of Israeli Cuisine. And my understanding, again, sight unseen, is that the director and writer, Roger Sherman, essentially asked this particular director to travel back to Israel and look at the influence of food, how food has influenced him personally, as well as how things have evolved from a culinary perspective in Israel. And as the title says, it's In Search of Israeli Cuisine. And I want to see it, hopefully not on an empty stomach. So, Rashmi, you saw it, as did you, Joseph?
I did indeed, okay. Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the most... Yes. One of the most pivotal lines in this movie is said by a Palestinian chef, which is, you know, you don't create a kitchen from day to day. You create it from generation to generation. Mm. And rather like the movie Kedi, I think to think of this documentary as just about food would do it a great disservice. I'm saying exactly the same line. Mm. This is a delightful documentary about food and culture and how we eat and what we eat and what a place does to its people and the food they eat. Mm. Delicious.
Yeah, I mean, if I want to be harsh on the movie, I think at times it feels like an extended edition of an Anthony Bourdain show. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a travel show focusing on a show about food in a specific location and culture. But that's being mean because the movie is so much more than that. I think it's very much a tribute to the food and the culture of post-war Israel. I think the movie is very informative in terms of, you know, the history of modern Israel. You know, I think, you know, there's a kind of a growing subculture about food, and it explains why that is. You know, Israel, if you remember, was formed in, you know, the last century, the modern Israel, with people coming in from all sorts of different cultures and bringing their foods and flavors with them to a part of the world that already had a very rich food culture. You know,
and was on the spice route.
The geographical location there. You think about the history of the Middle East. You know, there's a lot of different foods and flavors, and like you say, the spice route. So this movie is a lovely little exploration of that. I think it comes from one viewpoint, and it tries. It's best to not be political. I think it's difficult to talk about Israel without getting into some discussion of politics. And, you know, the movie does a nice job of kind of dancing around that, although, you know, it's not afraid of that either. You know, there's a little line in the movie where, you know, a Palestinian chef talks openly about the difficulties that he has whenever tensions get high between, you know, Israel and Palestine. You know, there's a big downturn in the Jewish Israeli population attending his restaurant. You know, they're making a political statement by not going to his restaurant. But other than that, it's wonderful little piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the people in this documentary are as colorful as the food they create and as diverse as the food they create. They have one thing in common, which is they are fiercely passionate. I mean, fiercely passionate about the idea of local and being Israeli and what the new world means and what they want in the future. And, you know, I mean, I think I also had the note about the Anthony Bourdain joke, because we obviously watch Anthony Bourdain. We love to travel and we love to eat. But I think what it does differently is it spends a little bit of time asking some difficult questions and finding quite a balanced way in the way those questions are answered politically. And the documentary does a good job, I think, of trying to say food isn't political, except in this case it is, because of exactly what you said, Joe, because it is a melting pot and because of the way the nation has been shaped. And I think Israeli people feel it's important to portray a certain image, and they want to be a certain type of person, and they want their cuisine to represent them. And that's why it's an important movie.
Does it flow reasonably well?
Flawlessly, yeah. In my mind. There's no, you know, it flows so very nicely from one area to another, and then the history of how that area's cuisine came to be, and it highlights, you know, people who are there in an area who've been cooking there for the last 30 years, and not necessarily because they learned to cook, but they just like to cook what they eat.
It doesn't necessarily follow kind of a narrative flow. I mean, I think it does go from region to region in Israel, and I think one of the things that it does very nicely is show you the different climate. You know, Israel is the size of New Jersey, and so...
Really?
Yeah, it's a tiny, tiny little place, relatively, you know, globally speaking, for the, you know, all that's talked about it. But it has these little microclimates. You know, there are different regions. There are mountainous regions. There are desert regions. You know, and they've...
There's the salt water that comes in and the fresh water.
Yeah, they've really done an amazing job of turning this piece of land into, you know, and, you know, and they're trying to do a lot of things locally. There's a lovely section in the movie where they speak with a restaurateur who is obsessed about only having things produced locally. You know, the farm to table type thing that's become very trendy over here is her reality, and it's been her reality for a long time, because, you know, she's trying to find these Israeli flavors. And I think that, you know, that's what I think, you know, I guess if there's a narrative flow to this at all, it is this idea, this concept of what is modern Israeli food. Because if you speak to anyone, the first thing that they'll say is hummus. But there's so much more to Israeli cuisine than hummus. But at the same time, you know, a lot of it is things that are brought in culturally from elsewhere. You know,
they talk religiously.
They talk about Ashkenazi food, you know, which is Eastern European, and as being, you know, very, very bland. I mean, you know, these did come from Eastern Europe, where they didn't have access to a lot of spices. So it was potatoes and vegetables.
Pickled things
that they needed to preserve together, you know. So those flavors have now been incorporated and melanged with these Middle Eastern cuisine, you know, spices and couscous and all sorts of things. Fascinating.
I'm suddenly very hungry.
I know. Well, and that's really the overriding emotion I had through the movie was, you know, like those good travel food shows, you know, they make you salivate at the food that's been prepared. It's simple, it's visual, but it's also, you know, it leaps off the screen onto your tongue, kind of thing. You experience those types of moments the passion of this particular person trying to explore what it is to be Israeli and what it is to have this food.
And Yasti, what food did you... when you were at the restaurant, what did you actually... Can you remember what you had?
Yeah, so they had like different hummus combinations. Mm-hmm. And I think there is one where it's the chef's choice in terms of how he tops your hummus. And then there are two other sections of small plates and big plates. Mm. And the small plates are meant for sharing. And I remember there was duck hearts, I kid you not. And it was brilliant. It was with grilled onions and, something else. And it was just amazing. And then there was a crispy potatoes. And that's why I was reminded of, you know, when you mentioned about potatoes. And then the big plates are kind of things which are cooked on charcoal, you know. And so you have a choice of either eggplant or your typical kebabs, or you have a fish, a branzino fish. And I was going to have the eggplant because I love eggplant. But the person who I went with, Joe, he said that, no, you have to try the branzino. And it just, it that was like, you know, the cherry on the pie. It was, it just knocked me out. It was so good, that fish. So it's kind of traditional, but it kind of tries different things with it. Yeah, you know?
And I think clearly what I came away with, because, you know, I love to cook as well. And so I think what I came away with was this guy who's searching for ideas for his restaurant, but is drawn back time and time again to his home place. And you know, we all are raised on the cooking of our mothers and our grandmothers. And so it goes deep. I think it explores that connection of who we are with the food we eat. So I can sum this one up. I mean, for me, the documentary does a delicious job of exploring how food can and may bring the world together in due course. But to think this is just a movie about food, I think would be a terrible underestimation. 7 out of 10.
That's a little stingier than I thought you'd be, because I'm coming in with an 8.
Okay.
In part because I think if you are a foodie, if you do like those, you know, things that we see on Travel Channel and CNN, then, you know, this is right up your street. It's just a deeper exploration of a specific culture. And I think my only real gripe with the movie, if I have to have one, and I usually have to have one, is that it doesn't go a little deeper into, you know, the modern day conflict. I think, you know, getting more of a sense for, you know, the people of that land, and, you know, the various viewpoints. But again, you know, I respect the fact that this, you know, what they were making here was more about the food than the politics. But I think it's very hard to separate all of that whenever you talk about Israel. So, it's an 8 out of 10 for me. And that comes from the kind of foodie side of me. I think if you're not as interested in food, you know, you maybe want to, you know, if hummus ain't your thing, then, you know, knock a point off, because I think it's very much about the flavors and the diversity of different cuisines available in this country, from fish to tomatoes to hummus to lamb to spices.
I'm so happy I put dinner on before we started the podcast.
Of Israeli food porn, that was ever a category to be.
And who knew that the cherry tomato was invented in Israel?
Well, one of the themes of the movie is just how industrious the Israeli people have had to be. You know, I mean, this land is not, you know, it's desert, right? And through means of irrigation, some of it, you know, inspired by ancient means, you know, there's a culture there that, you know, really was very clever at cultivating turning the desert into fertile land. You know, it's a clay based soil, but they diverted water from the mountains literally to again give themselves a means by which to grow produce. You know, all of this kind of stuff is touched in there. So, you know, for the technology and the winemaking, and there's so many little things.
Olive oil.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap up the podcast.
Our eggplants await.
Indeed. So, let's again, this podcast may come a little bit out of sequence, so forgive us for that, but we do have to respect movie studio embargoes, and this one was very clear. So, let us know what you think. Mail at movieworlders.com, twitter.com/movieworlders, facebook.com/movieworlders as well. Until our next podcast, whichever one that may be, too many movies, too little time. Goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.